Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April the 7th, 2021, and the time is 9:15. Please silence all cell phones. I want to thank all the support staff here today. Present today are Senators Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Hoffman will be along here shortly. Today's agenda, SB 95, Search and Rescue Surplus State Property, SB 89, Assisted Living Homes, SB 98, Adult Foster Care for Disabled, and SB 95 is up first, Search and Rescue. This is the first hearing of the bill. My intent is to hear and hold the bill's introduction and sectional analysis. Today is Senator Wilson and his trustee staff, Jasmine Martin. Staff to Senator Wilson, you can stay there or you can go at the table, wherever you want to go, sir. All right. I will tell you from experience, the other end of the table gives you a greater appreciation for the process. Senator Wilson. And good morning, Senator Hoffman. I told them that you were here. You would be right here. So, Senator, we're at full complement today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is David Wilson, Senator for District D. And with me is my staff, Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
Today, we have Senate Bill 95 with a search and rescue's right of first refusal. Mr. Chair, Alaska is the last frontier, and as a frontier, we're always exploring, and sometimes explorers get lost. But some of us someday possibly have or will have or need the help of the search and rescue party. By statute 18.60.120, the Alaska State Troopers lead search rescue efforts in the state. The mission relies heavily on over 1,100 search and rescue volunteers across Alaska. Many of these groups are purely voluntary and receive a little financial support from the state, and some of their expenses are reimbursed by the state, such as fuel, but in general, they don't receive compensation for their costs. We've seen many examples recently in the news of search and rescue groups. These groups provide invaluable support during the Haines avalanche, help find our lost children in the lower Yukon, and in the recent avalanche on Bear Mountain doing a recovery. This bill provides a small assistance for these groups at no cost to the state. It allows organized volunteer search and rescue groups in the state to exercise the right of first refusal for surplus state property related to search and rescue services before it's sent to state auction or otherwise disposed of. Currently, before the surplus goes to state auction, it first goes to reutilization. So it goes to other state departments to see if there is a need for that property. If those items can't be used by the state, it then goes to an auction. Senate Bill 95 allows the search and rescue organizations to exercise that right of first refusal before it goes to state, before the state property goes to public auction and be reutilized for other purposes. The right of first refusal means these groups are being given the first opportunity to buy this equipment at fair market price set by the Department of Administration, who handles those statewide auctions currently. This is a small way to help provide these tight budget times to these volunteer organizations that provide such valuable service to our state. This bill has zero physical note from the Department of Administration, and we have online representatives from the Department of Administration to answer questions on the mechanics of the disposal of the state property. And my staff, if Mr. Chair, if you will, Ms. Martin can do a quick sectional. I think it's a two-section bill.
Ms. Martin, please put yourself on the record and take us through the two-sectional bill.
So yes, for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Again, it's just a two-section bill. The first section names this act, the Ellie Mae Act. Section 2 amends AS 4468-110 to add a new Section C. This is our statutes dealing with the disposal of state property. And it just allows the organized volunteer search and rescue groups to exercise right of first refusal for state surplus items related to search and rescue before they're disposed of in auction.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator, for introducing this legislation. The search and rescue operations in my district, such as the Bethel Search and Rescue, are always struggling to find funds. And in most cases, they donate their funds out of their pockets to buy gas and other equipment. So why would we want to charge them full value of appraised value when they're doing a public service? It seems as though they should be able to get considerable discount to access this equipment, since they are performing a public function. And the second question that I have, Senator, is since there are so many search and rescue operations in the state, how would the search and rescue members compete for items that might be available that are highly prized to provide search and rescue operations?
Yes, thank you, Senator. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, this bill was just trying to allow those entities an opportunity to find discounted items. Many of those items that are on the state surplus website are at a discounted rate because of the use and because of the way that the state wants to dispose. And, you know, we've in the past have given search and rescue entities grants through the capital budget, and we felt this would be a good mechanism to allow them, instead of trying to find one vehicle to try to write a statute to give them a vehicle purchase. This would allow them more flexibility to a greater timeline to purchase that said equipment and to find a best suited to meet their needs, instead of waiting for, like I said, instead of assigning that one opportunity. So we're just trying to find a mechanism, and search and rescue entities have to be perform under the statute by the state troopers, I believe, and Ms. Martin can give a better explanation of that.
And so, through the for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, through the chair, they don't necessarily have to have performed a search and rescue party with the troopers, but it is in statute that they would be eligible to perform a search and rescue party.
Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just curious, on page one, line eight, how would a group of volunteers that is organized, how is that defined? Is that codified somewhere, or is there, could it be a Facebook group, or what do you need to meet that definition?
Through the chair, this is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Senator Willikowski, it is not defined anywhere in statute. This is essentially the definition for it. We wanted to be careful not to make the definition so narrow. We were leaving out search and rescue groups, and not so broad that any person could take advantage of this program. And so Department of Administration has broad authority in these statutes already to regulate disposal of state items. And so we have basically left this up to the Department of Administration to determine how they're going to make those lists.
Thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line six, who is Ellie Mae?
Thank you. For the record, Senator Wilson. Many search and rescue groups are service sort of canines, and Ellie Mae was a service canine, and we thought it would be good to honor a fallen canine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson, I want to call on Jonathan Harshfield, State Property Manager, Department of Administration. Jonathan, are you online? All right, we're going to turn the volume up here just for a second so we can hear you. Let's try that. Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Jonathan Harshfield, State of Alaska Property Manager.
So, Mr. Harshfield, you're the person in charge of disposing of excess property, et cetera, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. So can you tell me, so this bill as written, so these, can you give me a couple of hypothetical situations? I'm not going to hold your feet to the fire on excess property. Let's, and I'll give you the scenario. Maybe the search and rescue from Manly Hot Springs is going to apply for some excess property in the state fleet, and that consists of a 20-foot boat with an outboard motor that you've got in excess property. So how would that work? How would the Hot Springs search and rescue entity apply for that boat, and what would it cost them?
First of all, Senator, they would have to go through a brief qualification process that we're working on setting up right now to ensure that they are indeed a search and rescue group, not just individuals looking to get discounted property. Once that happens, they would become a member of our GovDeals online auction. They would go into a tier where they could only see property coming from the Department of Public Safety that's going up for auction. Every piece of property going up for auction in this tier would have a predetermined minimum bid. Depending on the property, that would be set between myself and DPS, and using variables from other auction sites throughout the country to determine that price. And once that's on auction, they would have about between 7 and 14 days the auction would be open, and they could come in and bid on that property, and the highest bidder would walk away with the property and the need to transport it and get it to their location.
Thank you. And please forgive me, I'm omitted. Could you put your name and affiliation on the record?
Jonathan Harshfield, State of Alaska Property Manager.
Okay, so now that's one option. So they're going to bid competitively within other state agencies?
They would compete with other search and rescue groups.
Okay, other search and rescue groups. Next question. Does the state of Alaska have a reutilization program within state agencies, meaning let's say AST, Alaska State Troopers, turns in a 20-foot boat, 40-horse motor, and do you have a process where, let's say, DNR says, oh, I could use that boat for Elodia eradication? Does DNR have first right of refusal, and they can go screen that boat and suck it over to DNR? Tell me how that works.
There's multiple tiers within the GovDeal auction. The first tier is open to departments within the state. They have multiple representatives. Each department has multiple representatives on this auction. This auction's at no cost to the state. Basically, they can go in, see an item that they need to use. They get approval from their department to pull it from the auction. They click a button, and my staff will make the necessary document transfers to move it over to their department, and then their department is required to come and pick it up. If, while on auction for state agencies, it does not go out to a state agency, then it would move to the second tier, which is going to be the search and rescue groups. If a search and rescue group does not buy it while it's on auction, and it'll be on auction between 7 and 14 days, then it would move to the general public auction to be sold to the general public.
Can you give me an example? Is there any other state-affiliated agencies that might have, I call it a screener's card for state property? Mm-hmm. And is there other agencies where I'm trying to go with this is getting back to Senator Hoffman's original question. A lot of these search and rescues operating on a shoestring. I applaud the sponsor of the bill bringing it forward. I'm just walking through here trying to see if there's a way we can make these assets available at as with the least amount of financial burden as possible. So anyway, Not really a question in there. Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on your question. So the way the process would work if this were to pass is there's a first tier, and that's for state agencies. So in the case of the boat that came available, Department of Natural Resources maybe comes in and says, hey, we want that boat. But if nobody if no state agency says they want it, then it would go to the second tier, which would be available for the search and rescue groups. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, Senator.
And just, if I could, Mr. Chairman, just looking at the language, this says, I don't necessarily read the language that way. It says may exercise first right, a right of first refusal. So how are the search and rescue groups in the second tier when they have the right of first refusal in line 10 under this bill?
Did you understand the question, Mr. Harshfield, or do we need to repeat it again?
They're in the right of first refusal to any agency outside of the state.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson?
And drafting this bill, for the record, this is Senator David Wilson. In drafting this bill, we're looking at the first refusal because the state still owns that equipment. So this is a state releasing ownership of that equipment. So if another department's in need of a state-owned asset, it's just transferring to a department rather than being put up for sale or being disposed of. And so that's why it's sort of that first refusal is in there. We had a similar question, too. And so that's part of the reason why it's worded that way.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and then just following through on the process. So there's a vote. The no state agency wants it. A group of volunteers say, hey, we could use that boat. Who gets title to the boat? Does an individual within that group get it? And at some point in time, if the volunteers disbanded, would that become a personal possession of that group, of that person? How does that work?
Is that question for me, Senator?
Yes. Yes, for the department.
The group would, most likely the leader of the organization would get title to the boat. That's a good question about disbanding. I don't think that's been thought through yet, but that's something we can definitely work on.
Okay. Mr. Harshfield, are you familiar with the federal government's Department of Reutilization for excess federally property?
I am somewhat. Yes, Senator.
All right. Well, I'll come back to that. Senator Hoffman and then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the process as well, and so do you provide a list of surplus property to the agencies, and then after that is taken off, then that list, how is that list disseminated to the nonprofits? Are you going to get a list of those search and rescue nonprofit agencies or all search and rescue? Are you going to solicit the list so that you can disseminate what has not been accessed by departments of the state? And how frequent do you do these lists, and are they on a scheduled basis in the state?
There is no scheduled basis, Senator. Basically, we will work with the Department of Public Safety and reach out to currently known search and rescue departments, asking if they want to partake in this program. If they do, we'll get them a login and username for the govdeals.com auction. Prior to items going through this tier, we'll send out a list to the registered users saying this will be on auction next week. You may want to pay attention if this is something you're interested in, and then it'll go on to the auction for 7 to 14 days. Allowing them to bid as they will to pull the items off auction.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I'm just following up on Senator Wilikowski's question and then the following answer. I find it interesting that an individual person who happened to be on a de facto rescue team would claim ownership or title of the snow machine, the boat, the trailer, whatever it may be, versus an entity that is an ongoing concern in perpetuity as rescuers come and go over time. Is it going to go any which way, depending on the community and whether there are an organization, a nonprofit? I just think it's interesting that we would be selling state assets to an individual. Do we do that?
And Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Martin may have an answer to that question.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, I think you would like to add something to the conversation.
So Jasmine Martin, for the record, through the chair. So there is already in administrative code, in regulation, a process for what happens to a piece of equipment the state has purchased for a search and rescue group. There isn't obviously any regulations for a piece of property that's purchased through this program because the program doesn't exist yet. But I imagine this would be something that would be in regulation. Right now, the leader of a group takes responsibility for a piece of property, but they don't necessarily take ownership of that piece of property, if that makes sense.
Yes, follow up. Then who would take ownership, and do we need to have something written that it has to be a 501c3, 501c3b, something along that line? Does it need to have a home?
Through the chair again, this is Jasmine Martin for the record. Senator Von Imhoff, we discussed whether or not we wanted to make it certain types of organizations, but we were worried that that would leave out different types of volunteer organizations. The organization itself would take possession of the item, but again, we didn't want to really narrowly define what organization would be eligible for this program because we would leave out other organizations.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Harshfield, can you give us an example of some of the items that we would be considered excess property? I mean, do you have things like sleds, and do they go all the way to helicopters if you're trying to talk about search and rescue?
Jonathan Harshfield, state property manager for the record. Senator, yes, it would. It would be anything that the Department of Public Safety's Search and Rescue Department deems to go into that tier. It could be anything from a snow machine to a sled being pulled behind the snow machine to snowshoes.
Follow up, Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Harshfield, so you're including helicopters and the disposal thereof of some of the excess DPS aircraft that are out there?
From my understanding, Senator, yes, it would include those.
Mr. Chairman, my last question has to do, I think, more with the sponsor of the bill. You talked about different entities out there, and there are organizations that have played a major part over the 50 years of statehood, and that's the Civil Air Patrol. Are they eligible for excess property that may come up for available?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, because they would be including a search and rescue party under that AS statute. The Civil Air Patrol would qualify under this bill.
Even though they get federal funds?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Clarification, Senator Olson brought up surplus property of the Department of Public Safety, but isn't it in fact the way that it is written here, that it could be from the Department of DOT or any other departments that have surplus equipment, as long as the entity can show that it's going to be used for search and rescue?
For the record, this is David Wilson. Yes, that is our understanding. This is the way the bill is written, and maybe Mr. Harshfield from the Department of Administration could also clarify that as well. I believe that we're looking at the troopers would help find the organizations and would help verify that this is a legit search and rescue organization and not some backpacker snow machiners group that's looking for a cheap deal on a sled. But Mr. Hartsfield may be able to clarify that.
Mr. Hartsfield, is the senator accurate on his answer?
That process hasn't been put in place yet, Senator, but it soon will be.
Yeah, okay, maybe it'll be out in the CS to help them with the process. Okay, any other questions?
One last question to clarify, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
The premier search and rescue operation here in the state of Alaska is the North Slope Burr, and I used to fly for them. Are they eligible for these excess properties as well?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, only if they're a volunteer organization.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. All right. Seeing no further questions, we're going to open public testimony. Public testimony is open. I don't see anybody online to testify. Anybody in the room want to testify? Public testimony is closed. Any other discussion before we set this bill aside? Thanks for bringing it, Senator Wilson, and we'll set this bill aside. Next up is, let me turn my page, SB 89, Assisted Living Homes. This is the first hearing of SB 89. It's our intent to hear and hold this bill. Bill introduction and sexual analysis will be Mr. John Lee, Director, Division of Senior and Disability Services, Department of Health and Social Services. Mr. Newman, Deputy Director, Division of Senior and Disability Services, is available for questions, as well as Lynn Cruz and Mr. Craig Baxter. So, are they online? Mr. Lee, can you hear us?
For the record, this is John Lee. I'm the Director of Senior and Disability Services. Thank you. I was waiting for my line to be unmuted, and it is now. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir, we can. Please introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Yes, this is John Lee. I'm the Director of Senior and Disability Services, and to the chair, why is this bill needed? Alaska statutes are not in compliance with federal regulations that require home and community-based service providers to give people who are on waivers the same access to the community as people who are not on waivers. For example, state law allows that an assisted living home may establish house rules that address residents' right to have visitors, while state statute says the rules may not be unusually restrictive. Federal regulations is more explicit, stating that individuals on waivers and in such settings are able to have visitors of their choosing at any time. Although Alaska received initial approval from the federal government for its plan to bring its settings into compliance, the approval was contingent on the state revising its statute to reflect this federal requirement. Ongoing financial participation in the state's waiver program by the federal government is reliant on services being provided in a compliant setting. Without this amendment to the state statute, the federal government matches in jeopardy. What does this bill do to address this need? This proposal is a simple insertion of language into the assisted living home statutes, Alaska Statutes 47.33, that will bring the state into compliance with Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services home and community-based setting requirements, protecting Alaska's federal share of the Medicaid payments for home and community-based waiver services. Who will be impacted by this bill? Alaska's approximately 700 assisted living homes would be required to abide by the conditions defined in the bill. This new statutory language would afford all residents living in an assisted living home the same rights regardless of whether the home accepts Medicaid as payment. The vast majority of the homes, about 650, are already fully in compliance with the conditions set forth in this legislation because they've been certified to operate as home and community-based waiver service providers under these conditions. Is there a timeline? So what's the timeline for this? All states are required to comply with the CMS rule on setting by March 2023. And what is the fiscal impact of this bill? Zero. And with your permission, Chair, I would like to read this sectional analysis if you would like.
Hang on a second. All right, please proceed.
Thank you. To the Chair, Section 1 amends Alaska Statutes 47.33.060, House Rules for Assisted Living Homes, to explicitly require consistency with federal regulations when house rules are established. Section 2 adds a new section for assisted living homes to make explicit that assisted living homes that provide waiver services may not adopt house rules inconsistent with federal regulations. And Section 3 carries the statutory amendments proposed in Section 1 and Section 2 of the bill to Alaska Statute 47.33.300 regarding a resident's right to have visitors. Subject to your questions.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. As I look at the code of the CFR, if I'm reading this correctly, it requires individuals are able to have visitors of their choosing at any time. Is that the section that's being added in Section 2?
Through the Chair, this is Director John Lee, Director of Senior Disability Services. That is correct.
Follow-up?
So does the provider have or the assisted living home have any say if a visitor is unruly or if they're coming in at, say, 3 in the morning and creating a disturbance? Is there – what sort of protections are there against that for the other residents?
To the Chair, if you would like to call Craig Baxter from Healthcare Services, he may be in the best position to address this question.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. Mr. Baxter, are you online with us?
To the Chair, this is Craig Baxter with Residential Licensing. If an individual is being unruly or inappropriate in a facility, the facility would, my understanding is the facility, even under the CFR, would be able to restrict that visitor's access. They would have to have a valid reason for it. In addition to that, if the resident had a guardian or some sort of legal representative, or the resident themselves felt that the individual shouldn't be there, they could restrict that individual's visitation. But that would have to be part of their plan and be incorporated into that plan in conjunction with their guardian. So, yes, they would be able to restrict or prevent a person from coming in if they were being unruly or disruptive.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, we're going to go to public testimony. We're going to open public testimony. And we're going to close public testimony as soon as I check the room to see if anybody in here wants to testify. And I don't see anybody wants to testify. So public testimony is closed. Any other committee business to come before the committee before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we set this bill aside. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up the screen for our next presentation. Brief at ease. Finance is back on the record. Up next is Senate Bill 98, Adult Foster Care for the Disabled. This is my first, this is our first hearing of SB 98. My intent is to hear and hold the bill. Again, bill introduction is sexual analysis. Same gentleman, Mr. John Lee, Director of Division of Senior and Disability Services. Mr. Newman, Deputy Director of Division of Senior and Disability Services. Then we also have Ms. Cruz, Ms. Chrissy Vogley, Mr. Baxter online for questions. Mr. Lee.
To the chair, this is Director John Lee. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Please put yourself on the record.
John Lee. I'm the Director of Senior Disability Services, and it's my great pleasure to take part in the presenting this bill on behalf of the governor. Senate Bill 98 addresses an urgent need to establish safe residential living environments for certain foster care children who must transition out of foster care system upon turning 18 years of age. This bill provides for a means for current foster parents to transition their existing foster care license to a new adult foster care home license in order to allow their foster child to remain in the same home with the same family when the child is released from state custody. If you would like to the chair, I'd like to call on my deputy director, Tony Newman, for the formal presentation of the bill and the sectional analysis.
Thank you. That'd be perfect. Mr. Newman, you're up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bishop and members of the committee. This is Tony Newman. I'm the Deputy Director at the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and I'm grateful to spend time with you all to discuss Senate Bill 98. Let me start by describing the type of individual that this bill is meant to serve. This is a person who starts out life, sometimes from the moment of birth, with a disability that could be due to a range of conditions, from autism to Down syndrome. And sometimes they have even more complex and serious medical conditions, severe cerebral palsy, cystic fibrosis, or other disorders that can mean a lifetime of intensive medical treatments and prolonged dependence on technology. It's impossible to say there's a typical child this bill would apply to, given the range of conditions and functionality they may have, but at the very least, they're assessed as having a disability such that they could receive services in an institution or a skilled nursing facility, and so therefore are eligible to participate in one of Alaska's home and community-based Medicaid waivers. Adding to their challenges, these children also are in foster care because their parents are unable or unwilling to give them the care they need. At any given time in Alaska, roughly 20 children are in state's custody and have the kind of disabilities I'm describing here. But thanks to the wonderful people who serve as foster parents in our state, and thanks to the state's waiver programs, these kids can enjoy a secure and safe life in a home setting, not an institution, surrounded by people who know and love them and are often willing to care for them throughout their lives. The need for the bill arises because of changes that occur when the youth reaches adulthood. The foster parent who has known the child, often for their entire life, and who has grown intimately familiar with the child's needs, is no longer able to offer traditional foster care once the child ages out of state custody. There are also disincentives and obstacles that can make it difficult for the foster parent to transition to some kind of new caregiving arrangement, which in turn makes it hard for that young person to remain with those same people, who may be the only family they know. This may force the young person into a new living situation that can be a traumatic change, sometimes requiring not just a new place to live and new people to live with, but even requiring the child to leave their home community. So a few years ago, constituents to then-Senator Dunleavy brought these concerns to his attention, and in 2017, State Senator Dunleavy introduced a bill, SB 10, that sought to address this issue. The approach was still being refined when the governor left the Senate, but his interest in addressing this remained, and several months ago he asked us to return to work on the issue. The governor's entreaty to the department was for us to find as straightforward and easy a way as possible for that foster child and those foster parents to remain together as a family when the child becomes an adult, if they so choose. So the graphic we've provided is a handout for you, and that I now see is available on screen thanks to your wonderful staff's help, is the best way we could think of to illustrate what happens now and how the bill attempts to provide a solution. The service structure at Senior and Disability Services is fairly complex. But this diagram gets to the heart of the matter well, and I want to thank my teenage daughter, Meredith, for her help putting this together. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll walk through this slide quickly.
Please.
Thank you. So on the left, we have our youth, and below him, a checklist of the kinds of services and supports the youth can receive. The first checkbox shows how the caregiver is reimbursed to provide care to the youth, either through child family home habilitation services at $157 a day, or through the foster care stipend available to foster parents. Now, this amount can vary, but $70 is a fair approximation for the stipend the foster parent of one of these children would receive, according to the Office of Children's Services. Whether the foster parent elects to choose to do child family home habilitation or get the foster care stipend will depend on their own personal situation. But the higher rate for child home habilitation reflects the fact that there are higher expectations for the administration of that program. In either case, the foster parent will be licensed by OCS as a foster home. These youth are also eligible to receive personal care services, that is, a paid individual coming into the home regularly to provide help with the activities of daily living, eating, toileting, dressing, bathing. In speaking with the constituents that brought this issue to the governor's attention, they noted that personal care services are very much valued by these foster parents because those tasks are some of the most exhausting and challenging work in raising these kids. And last under the child's list is an empty checkbox showing few additional waiver services. These are services that are primarily meant to enhance independent living, such as transportation, meals, and employment services that typically a child won't need because they are being cared for by an adult. Now, follow the white upwards arrow labeled typical current path into that child's adulthood, and you can see that if a child has been served by family home habilitation, the rate is reduced from $157 a day under the child services to $126 a day for adult family home habilitation. The adult family home habilitation rate is reduced because these individuals are generally in need of less hands-on parental-style caregiving, and also because they receive a wider menu of waiver services to promote their independence. They also lose personal care services because greater independence and self-care for the young adult is assumed to be occurring. Instead of a foster care license, if the child is to remain in the same home, the foster parent would need to apply for an assisted living home license, which means working with a different agency and meeting different expectations around safety policies and procedures, space requirements, and other things. I want to point out that while they could be eligible to receive from the menu of additional waiver services, and that's the last box checked in that list, many of these young people, particularly the most medically fragile, have conditions that make it hard for them to take really good advantage of these services often. So to summarize, when the child becomes an adult, the foster parents have lost the ability to receive the foster care stipend. If they've been offering child family home habilitation, their rate of daily reimbursement has been reduced. They've lost the ability to receive personal care services for the young adult. They would have to set up their home to meet licensing requirements for an assisted living home. And while the young adult would have a wider range of potential services to draw from, if they have a severe medical condition, their ability to take advantage of those services may be limited. The bottom line is that for the foster parents who maintain the youth in their home, they face some high hurdles and difficult choices. And I want to emphasize that this is a common path for the former child, but it's just one path. There are other living arrangements and approaches that the foster parent and the former child could pursue to stay together, but those have other expectations and drawbacks that are frequently less attractive options. So what we've proposed in SB 98 is a new path that makes it easier for the foster parent and the former foster child to stay together. Instead of offering adult family habilitation, the foster parents could be certified as adult foster care providers and receive a daily stipend that has lighter expectations around providing habilitative services, but does pay more than a basic room and board style rate. Instead of an assisted living home license, the department would create a new adult foster home license that offers a smooth and direct transition from the child foster care license. The menu of other services would still be available to those that can benefit from them. They would receive personal care services if that's indicated in their plan. But the best thing of all would be the continuity of care the bill would allow. The family in the home that has been familiar to this young person much of their lives, maybe all their lives, would continue to be that place they know and are comfortable in. I want to emphasize nobody would be forced into this new arrangement. The top option and others would still be available to these individuals if they decide they want to strike out and move into a new living situation. But for those that do want to stay together longer, this could be an attractive option. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my introduction to the bill. I'm happy to stop for questions here, review the sectional analysis, proceed in whatever way you'd like.
Thank you for that overview. I'm going to look to the table for questions here first before we go through the sectional. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Can you talk about the estimate of how many people will be impacted by this and the total cost?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Like I mentioned, there are roughly 20 children right now that are both on a Medicaid home and community-based waiver and in foster care. For the purposes of our fiscal analysis, we estimated a maximum of 10 youth per year transitioning into this service if they desire. If you would like me to do a quick overview of the fiscal notes, I can do that at this time.
No, that's fine. We can cover that later. Appreciate it, though. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you look at the proposed path versus the typical current path, you're talking about an assisted living home license versus an adult foster home license. What's the difference between the two, and how difficult is it to get an adult foster home license?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, at this time, we don't have an adult foster home license. That's what this bill would create. Would set up the basic statutory allowance for us to do that, and then through regulation, we would define the details of what an adult foster home license would involve.
Follow up, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much more difficult is it to get the adult foster home license versus the assisted living home license?
To the chair, Senator Olson, the intention of the bill, in fact, I think the policy statement in Section 1 of the bill makes it clear that our goal here is to provide for a streamlined transition from the child foster home license to the adult foster home license. So that's going to be the overriding goal here in creating this new type of license is to make sure it's a relatively quick and similar sort of home license as a child foster home.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
You're talking about $126 a day with no personal care services, and you're talking about $115 a day with personal care services. Why is it not costing you more for the personal care services you're providing when on the paper it says you're actually getting less? What are you skipping out that we're not seeing here?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I just wanted to represent through the checkboxes what those specific services are going to pay. So personal care services would be a separate cost that'll depend on the individual's needs and how much personal care they need, but it will be an additional cost. So the resources devoted to the individual receiving adult foster care, while they will be less of a daily rate, and you're right, it is it would be going from a choice of $126 a day to $115 a day, but there's going to be less expectation on part of the adult foster, I'll call them adult foster care provider. They won't be expected to provide the same degree of habilitative services that they would if they were going to certify as an adult family home habilitation provider. And they'll also be able to enjoy the presence of the personal care services provider that will come into the home and assist them. I hope that helps. I'm happy to clarify further.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilson, Wilikowski, if you got a question, go ahead. But I want him to come back and then do the sectional.
Okay. I just had some questions on the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman. But if you want to hold off, I can.
Yeah. Let's hold off on the fiscal note. Let's take us through the sectional.
Certainly. So Section 1 of Senate Bill 98 adds a new section, 4707, to declare that it's the state's policy to support individuals who are or were in need of custody under the state child in need of aid statutes, who are residing in a licensed foster care home and eligible for home and community-based waiver services by providing a means for the individual to remain in the same home with the same families when they are released from state custody after turning 18 years. This section requires the department to make efforts to implement adult foster care in a streamlined manner, and the new section created sets out the provision for the department to assist foster parents with transitioning from a foster care license to an adult foster care home license, to pay the cost of maintenance necessary to assure the adequate care for an adult foster care recipient, and allow the individual to receive habilitative and rehabilitative care in addition to the adult foster care service, and allows us to adopt the regulations that we'll need to implement the section in the bill. Section 2 adds a new entity, adult foster care homes, that still be subject to the centralized licensing functions of the department, where assisted living homes and other residential programs are licensed. Section 3 adds a new section to AS 4732, defining the conditions under which the department may license an adult foster care home. This section requires the department to streamline the application process necessary for the person to be approved as an adult foster care home provider, and requires the department to approve of variances to building code requirements to the extent permitted by law. Section 4 amends 4732-900 to add a new paragraph defining adult foster care home as a residence where the adult head of household provides 24-hour care for not more than two adults for compensation or reimbursement under the adult foster care service. Section 5 amends the uncodified law by adding a new section requiring the Department of Health and Social Services to submit for approval to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services an amendment to the state medical plan, state medical assistance plan, or waivers as necessary to allow eligible individuals to receive adult foster care services. And Section 6 has two parts, amending the uncodified law by adding instructions regarding the change of the name of Department of Health and Social Services to Department of Health as proposed under the governor's executive order to reorganize the department. It also requests that if this bill and another bill that amend the term crisis stabilization center to read subacute mental health facility both become law, the revisor of statutes would give effect to both changes of terms.
Thank you.
And that concludes the sectional.
Senator Wilikowski.
On the fiscal note, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I'm just looking at one of the fiscal notes. It's OMB component 3234, and it's got a it shows an increment of $115 a day, which is what you have. Is there a concurrent decrement for the $126 per day that we are currently paying?
Through the chair, that is a great question, Senator Wilikowski. We do see this bill as a potentially lower cost alternative for some of the youth compared with what they are receiving now or what they may be able to receive now in terms of services. We considered whether the bill will save money. The service would be less than family home habilitation, and it would be less per day than another service called group home assisted living, which many youth could wind up in. But on the other hand, it is possible that some youth, some people who are keeping these youth in their homes are forgoing providing a residential habilitative service. Because they can get personal care services if they forego those and not have to license their home as an assisted living home or be certified to provide that service. So in a nutshell, we think it's probably going to basically be a wash as opposed to offer any real serving, real savings that we can calculate.
Senator Wilikowski, excuse me, follow up, then Senator Von Emmer.
I mean, it just seems to me that we're adding by 2027, $2.9 million per year under this provision. I know the feds pick up 1.7 of that. But it seems to me that we should be reflecting some sort of decrement from, because otherwise we're funding twice. We're funding for the $126 a day for the adult family home habilitation on top of the 115. That just doesn't make sense to me, Mr. Chairman. That's all.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, comment? Mr. Newman?
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to take a closer look on that and see if we can make any sort of assumptions or good estimates as to what potential savings might be and get back to the committee.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think to Senator Wilikowski's point, these fiscal notes are difficult to estimate because we have to estimate what human behavior and human decisions are going to be. And when a person is reaching the age of, I'm assuming, 19, 20, 21, and has to make a decision, the family unit, they're going to go to A or B, or then there's maybe even C that we don't even see on this screen. And so I think that it could be up to this amount or it could be around this amount. I mean, it's really hard to get it correctly. Using though other conversations that we've had in the past when we talked about the Pioneer Home and we talked about assisted nursing facilities, there has been public testimony and invited testimony in the past where home and family settings generally are win-win scenarios. They cost less than institutionalized, and generally the family and the patient has a better experience. And that is why I believe that there's been a movement, particularly for elder care, to try to stay in their homes to the degree possible versus moving to institutionalized care, depending on their severity of their, I don't know, their situation. This is, to me, is a very good step in the right direction. I think we're gonna have to wait a few years for the money to kind of wash itself out to see who chooses to do what. Thank you. It was just a comment, not really a question, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since you're holding this piece of legislation for further consideration, before we take action on it, I would request the department to give at least me the information on the population base of 15, 16, and 17-year-olds by community that currently exists, so we can see where the need is throughout the state of Alaska. So if the department can provide that to the committee before we take action on this piece of legislation, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Newman, did you hear Senator Hoffman's ask?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we will put that together for the committee.
Thank you, and get it to our office and we'll distribute it. Thank you. Next questions from committee members? I have one. This is, well, in the macro, my first reading of the bill, I mean, I think it's a, I concur with Senator Von Imhoff's comments. My question is, right now, it's not law yet, so are you able to, do you have a good feeling that you'll be approved for the waiver to do this?
Senator Bishop, we are. We know that other states offer an adult foster care service, and while the different states define that service differently, we do know that they do approve it, and we think that this will be seen as a good alternative.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from committee members? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this question didn't come up in Hess, but this would be similar to the number of children technically that would want to stay in OCS custody until the age of 21. Do you have any idea of maybe, I know this is a separate department, but if the different division, but if the department could get back to the committee with the number of children that choose to stay into OCS custody for similar reasons, for those continued health benefits or continued benefits of additional sort of the same assisted living services, that would be beneficial to get a better idea of the number of children that may want to stay in the adult foster care system in a comparison.
So, Senator, through the chair, if I may, Senator Wilson, to clarify, you're looking for the number of children who age out of the foster care system but choose to remain in their same home?
No, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, no. So children that are in OCS custody, if they have certain disabilities, they can choose not to leave OCS custody at the age of 18, and they can stay until age of 21 to continue to receive certain Medicaid additional services through their disability, depending on what disability they may have or different situations, they can choose to stay in the OCS system for additional activities of daily living assistance and other items of that nature. So they can choose to stay and not be sort of discharged, or if the youth decides to do that. So some can stay in the residential group homes until the age of 21, and they don't have to leave.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Wilson. We will work with OCS to see what we can provide to you.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski?
Is there some sort of provision, I assume you can't do it under this bill, but somewhere else where a disabled adult not on foster care as a youth could be considered under this program?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, right now the bill is limited to people who have left child foster care. That is something, though, that that we have been talking about at the Division of Senior and Disability Services. But for the purposes of meeting the governor's direction to us for this bill is limited to those leaving child foster care.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, we're going to open for public comment. Public comment is open. And nobody's online, nobody in the room wanted to, is there three people? Really? Huh. Oh, hang on. Let's see. Michael Jeffrey?
Jeffrey from Burr?
Yep.
From Utiavik, are you online?
Yep. Yes, I am.
Okay, could you please introduce yourself for the record and provide us with 2 minutes of testimony, please?
Sure. Well, to the chair, this is Michael Jeffrey. I'm a retired Superior Court judge, lived in Utqiagvik over 40 years, and had a 32-year career as a Superior Court judge where I dealt with both juvenile foster care and then the issues of as a youth became an adult sometimes how everything fell apart because they lost these services and so I strongly support the idea of making it easier for foster care families and the youth to maintain that relationship that they've built for many of these youth, like those with FASD and so on. It's very hard for them to build these relationships, and the bill would salvage all that and lead to a much better future. Now, I'm realizing as I've listened to the hearing that, and I don't have a copy of the bill, that at the moment it's limited to particular people who have these extra services, and that's very important. I mean, the need is very great, and I, again, very strongly support the bill. But maybe at the same time, the legislature can consider the issue of making it possible for youth that are in foster care and have a good relationship with their family, and the family wants to continue to care for them, not to have to arbitrarily let them go when they age out, but have a more of a long-term option. So great idea, and maybe it could be expanded in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Next, we're going to go to Wasilla, And Linda Gianni from Wasilla, are you with us?
I am.
Thank you. Could you please put yourself on the record and provide us with your testimony?
My name is Linda Guyana, G-I-A-N-I, and I formerly was a care coordinator and noted that since the inception of the waiver system in the mid-90s, there never was a plan in place for individuals with complex medical conditions to transition to adulthood. So I first met with Senator Dunleavy. At that time, I was a care coordinator, and I was working with a number of children who were on the Children with Complex Medical Needs waivers, and some of them were transitioning to adulthood, and it was an extremely difficult process since none of the rules in adult assisted living really applied to them. Mainly, the critical issue was the loss of in-home support services. So when they turned 18 on the CCMC waiver and went on to an adult assisted living waiver, they no longer could receive in-home support services. These are the most critical services that are needed by these individuals. Medical issues that they experience most often or more often than not worsen with age. They've grown in size and weight and have now become individuals who require a two-person lift, a two-person to provide most of their care, and then suddenly they have lost that ability. The other point is that they're entitled to habilitation services, which are supposed to lead to independent living, and we're talking about a group of individuals whose medical disabilities as well as their physical and mental disabilities are prohibitive. They will never be able to be in independent living. They will never be able to do anything independently. That, however, doesn't mean that they shouldn't be entitled to the services that they need. It is very possible with the appropriate supports, which in this case would be in-home support services, for each of these individuals to really have a great quality of life. If they're well cared for and everybody isn't burned out for providing their care, they're able to get out into their communities and meet people with health and weather permitting. So those are the main points that I have. Also cost-wise, my own son, who was very medically fragile, was in a group home. Cost versus foster care. My son's care was costing approximately $900 a day in a group home. The foster care, adult foster care, comes nowhere near that type of a cost. The other issue I wanted to bring up is the fact that when individuals turn 18, often they can stay under being with the Office of Children's Services, but at some point, all of these individuals have to get a legal guardian and go through that court system. So the decision of most of these individuals is made by the guardian. I'm guardian for two individuals who fall in this category, and I have to make decisions for them, and they are not able in any way to make decisions for themselves. So I really have been a proponent of the adult foster care ever since probably 2011 that I first started working with the senator, and have kept in contact now with Governor Dunleavy about continuing this process and trying to help these kids that have really not been, there hasn't been anything done for them in all of these years that the waiver system's been in place. So I highly support the bill. I'm very thankful that Governor Dunleavy has continued to support it as well. And I thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to stay in Wasilla, and we're going to have Lois Epperson, Adult Foster Care, Wasilla. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Please put yourself on the record and your testimony, please.
Yes, my name is Lois Epperson. I am an assisted living license provider. Used to be child foster care, first through Hope Community Resources and then OCS before having to change into assisted living license. And I live in Wasilla. I just want to say that my husband and I have cared for these extremely disabled children since about 1992 in our home. At one point we had two at the same time, but mostly one. And really, we support this adult foster license move because the kids, they get bigger and bigger and bigger. They actually need more care than they do when they're children. But we have provided a home for them, and if they have to move out into another, you know, bigger facility, it will disrupt their care. When we changed into an assisted living license on the personal level, it was a lot of stress on our home, a lot of expense for really nothing. We didn't get paid anymore, and our foster daughter lost services, and so you have to get very creative in order to get help. We're talking 24-hour care around the clock. Yes, if we can have respite or other services come in during those hours, those people will care for them. But ultimately, we are responsible for them. And, you know, they deserve a good life. And they deserve to be in a family that loves them and a place that they can maintain their health and their life for as long as they live. We're talking about the kids that we've cared for have been all in a wheelchair, none of them verbal. We work with G-tubes, trachs. These are children that were severely, you know, had birth trauma, and now they have a good family. And what we can do as a state to ensure that that can continue for them, I believe we should do in the state of Alaska. So I guess I have a lot of other things I could say concerning the stipend amount and that kind of thing, but perhaps that's for a different time. So anyway, thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you for your testimony. It's greatly appreciated. Next, I believe now that I've been lined out by my crew that we have no other online people. Anybody in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. I want to take just a brief at ease, real brief. On the record, okay. We're going to set this bill aside. It sounds like it's got a lot of support. We'll set it aside. And we're going to cancel this afternoon's meeting, and we'll be back here at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Can't wait.
We're adjourned.